This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
I have to be honest and speak frankly about my experience, especially as a black woman as well. But those moments with her, I definitely appreciated. And being able to, you know, look back at pictures, knowing that I was supported by Abigail's, and I'm still supported by Abigail's through my therapist. I've raised money for Abigail's. The charity is very, very close to my heart and definitely means an awful lot.
Welcome to Series 2 of A Journey with Abigail's Footsteps, a podcast about the difference this baby loss charity is making to lives across the country. I'm Nicola Everett, a proud ambassador of Abigail's Footsteps, a charity that supports families at the most difficult time and provides training for healthcare professionals. Sadly, in the UK, it's estimated that one in four pregnancies ends in the loss of a baby. Despite that figure, it's still something people find difficult to talk about, and parents can face a wall of silence. We're hoping this series of podcasts will break down that wall. Parents will share their own experiences, which at times can be difficult to listen to, but will also share their inspirational stories of resilience and hope, and how you can get involved in making a difference to so many amazing families. Welcome to episode 4 of A Journey with Abigail's Footsteps. On this episode, we'll be hearing about maternity care for black women and their families. Keji Moses is my first guest. She founded Maya's Legacy after the loss of her daughter. Keji, thank you ever so much for being on this episode for us.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's okay. Firstly, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind just sharing your story, just so we know a bit about you and your experience with baby loss, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Keji Moses. I'm the founder of Maya's Legacy. And Maya's Legacy is a UK-based charity, and we focus on advocating for compassionate care for women and families after baby loss. And the charity was started through my own personal experience of baby loss. My first experience of baby loss was in 2011. I had a miscarriage at 8 weeks, and I thought that was the worst experience that has ever could happen to anyone, let alone me. And I felt like I had done something wrong. And so through that experience, I said in my mind, consciously and unconsciously, that I never want this to happen to me ever again. But following on from that loss, I had a successful pregnancy, even though I didn't really enjoy that pregnancy, because every time I went to have my ultrasound done, I was, you know, had panic attack, anxiety, and I was always thinking of the worst case scenario. So, you know, moving on, I had my son. I was grateful for that experience, and he was well, and everything went well. Then, you know, after that, years after, I felt pregnant again. And this time I was really excited because it was a girl. I had two boys, and this was it. The family was complete. But 22 weeks into the pregnancy, they started to notice some abnormalities. Maya wasn't growing well, she wasn't progressing well, and they felt that the issues that they were witnessing and seeing in the scan can easily be resolved when she was born. So I was very optimistic. But that experience going into hospital every single time, because I had needed to go to a specialist hospital in London. I had like a normal ultrasound for me would be with 6-7 consultants in the room. It was quite isolating. And I just felt alone in a lot of those situations. And it was just one bad news after the other. But every time I saw a heartbeat, I was motivated to carry on because I wanted to fight for her because she was fighting on. But at 35 weeks, just a week before my planned C-section, I went into hospital and there was no heartbeat. That was the end of the pregnancy. And for me, it was even more, how can I put it? It was a lot more devastating for me because my prior experience of delivery was C-section. And, you know, that takes a toll on your physical body. But at this time, because she was lying across, I had to go through a C-section. I couldn't deliver naturally. So imagine my body having to go through this again, but not having to take my baby home. So I went into a state of depression. I went into a state of, I can't put words to it. I just felt like I couldn't carry on anymore. And I just remember the consultant saying to me, you know, you have to think about yourself. You have to think about your two boys who still need their mother. And I think those words really woke me up. And I thought, what can I do to change this pain into something else that would be able to support other families? And that's how Maya's legacy was birthed.
I always find it, Keji, so inspiring when people take such tragic and sad situation and say, do you know what? I am going to do something positive from this and help other people. Because that must have been difficult, though, despite what the consultant said. And you know, what he said kind of was for you maybe a bit of a wake-up call. But it's still really difficult, isn't it, to kind of, I don't know, move on and say, OK, I am going to do something positive for other people.
Yes, I think, and that's one of the what I speak about a lot, that grief has no ending. There is no expiry date for it. And there are times, even now, 4 years down the line, where I do find myself around her birthday, finding myself going into that space where I feel sad, you know, I feel angry sometimes. And even though I'm trying to support everybody else through the work that a charity does, there are moments that, you know, I just collapse really emotionally. And if there isn't any support system for families who've experienced loss, it can be isolating and it can lead to deep depression and PTSD.
And I guess that's why charities like yours and like Abigail's Footsteps are so incredibly important, because unfortunately the statistics for baby loss are still very, very high, aren't they?
Yes, it is very, very high. I mean, in a year, I think it was Tommy's reported 2023 that there was 250,000 miscarriages, you know, in the UK alone, not even, you know, looking at figures globally. It's more common than we speak about it. And in some cultures, there is an element of silence and shame around loss, because around with my culture as an British Nigerian, it was not something that we spoke about. Death wasn't something we speak about. It's particularly when it comes to baby loss and a death of a child, there is this assumption that, you know, that is a taboo and we shouldn't talk about it. So there is this urgency to move people on when they experience this without looking at the mental health and emotional impact of such an experience.
That's really interesting, because you said right at the very beginning when you were telling me about when you suffered your first miscarriage, you thought, have I done something wrong? Which obviously, of course, you didn't do anything wrong, but that was immediately how you felt. Do you think that's because of your culture and things that you'd heard from other people, and maybe not talking about baby loss before you had your first pregnancy?
Yes, because someone asked me, said something to me. I can't remember the exact words. And they alluded to maybe I didn't take my supplements, or maybe I didn't wasn't looking after myself. Well, there was that element of this only happens because there's something that you have done, and it's out of ignorance, really. And I think if that individual was, if they had really thought about what they were saying to me at that time, where I was emotionally vulnerable, mentally vulnerable, it was very insensitive. And those are some of the conversations that people listen to, where, you know, they are told, you just move on, you will have another child, and, you know, this wasn't meant to be, and, you know, be grateful that something, that that child may not have the quality of life that they you want them to have. And so this is more like a blessing in disguise. And, you know, even though they may feel like they meant well, for a person who has just gone through that, carrying a child, you know, they've lost, you know, that's a life that's gone. That's hope. That's a future that I've imagined that just been taken away from them. So there are conversations, and I'm looking onwards 4 years down the line, I am so happy that we're having this conversation, and organizations, you know, like SANS, like your organizations, Tommy's, and many other organizations out there are, you know, creating spaces where we can have this cultural sensitive conversation around baby loss.
And obviously you're trying to break down those barriers as well. Do you have a lot of mums come to you and have had similar experiences, unfortunately, to the one you've had? And obviously you've been able to share your experience and, as you say, break that taboo, I guess.
Yes. You know, not long after I had my experience, I had a phone call from a young mother who was in hospital, and she wanted to organize the funeral of her baby that passed on. And, you know, she was faced with a lot of conflict within herself, because her family, particularly parents, did not want her to be part of this. They encouraged her to allow the hospital to take care of it, and they encouraged her not to go to the funeral. And she was conflicted within herself, really, because she wanted to go to the funeral. She wanted to organize it. She wanted to be part of the whole experience. And when I got the phone call, I could understand, because those were the same issues that I had to face, where it was, you know, there was a discouragement not to really entertain any type of engagement with a funeral of a baby. And so, you know, my support for her at that time was that she needed to listen to her own intuition. She needed to listen to her and make that choice for herself. And she decided to do it.
Can that cause some conflicts within families still, though? If there is a very, very strong belief that you shouldn't be doing that, but someone does go with their heart, and as you said, you spoke to her about it, and she made that decision because it was right for her. But does it cause any conflict at all still?
Yeah, because the issues that comes out of those situation is that you feel like you can't talk about that, the experience anymore. It's because they have the conversation is like, this has happened, let's end it here. But because of that conflict, there is a reluctance to open up and talk about it within the family setting. So, you know, it can be isolated because you do still want to talk about those experiences. You do still want to talk about. I remember when I was, I think it was a year anniversary of Maya's passing, and I was alone at home, and I remember sitting down, and I was really very, very emotional, very teary. And I got a phone call from a family member, someone that was really close to me, and she was like, what's wrong? And I said, you know, I'm feeling a little bit low because, you know, today is Maya's birthday, and I was thinking about it. And they said, let sleeping dogs lie. And I lost it. I lost it. Like, how dare you make such an insensitive comment? And I just put down the phone. Then later, they apologized, but that's the sort of things that people will go through. And those conversations I had, because that individual wasn't trying to be mean or anything, but they were being insensitive, but they wanted me to move on. Like, why are you still thinking about this a year down the line? Move on from this experience.
It must be so amazing for you then that you are able to say Maya's name absolutely every single day, and her legacy lives on because of what you've been able to do and how many other people you've been able to help. That must feel amazing.
It is amazing. It is amazing when I get invited to, to collaborate and partner with East Kent Hospital at their bereavement unit, and being part of the steering group and having other families there involved in the whole process, and having that space where their voices are heard. It's incredible to be in rooms and spaces where I can talk and influence the way we do things and policies and processes and our approach and advocating for compassionate care. It is important for that message to carry on and for it to be done in Maya's remembrance and in Maya's name.
And Keji, would you say there needs to be specific tailored care for Black women in particular? Obviously, all women are incredibly important when they're going through this process, and what we say and how they're treated. Does there need to be particular attention, or is there something different for Black women that needs to be taken into consideration? Because you've mentioned those cultural differences, maybe, that perhaps medical staff don't appreciate necessarily at the time. Do those sorts of conversations need to be had?
Yes, I think those conversations need to be had. And one of the things that I feel is we can't rush through it. It is not another exercise and we come up with quick policies and then we tick the box and move on. It is understanding communities, culturally sensitive approach to communities and the differences in the way they deal with loss, in the way that they, even deal with pregnancy, and understanding those differences is so important, because that will inform the type of care we have. And if a Black woman sits in front of a practitioner, do not assume that all Black people are the same, or all Black women will respond in the same way, or our pain threshold, which is one that I hear a lot, is higher than other pregnant women. You know, we are so different, even though, the next Black woman is different from me. She might deal with things differently. Different cultures differently. Nigerian's approach to loss might be different from an Indian woman or an Asian woman in front of you. And understanding those differences would allow us to tailor the way we approach things differently. And if we can do that, there will be a lot of engagement. Women will have a better experience of birth, because you have to understand, in many cultures, childbirth is very sacred. From the time of conception to the time of delivery, women always have other women around them supporting them through that transition, because some see it as a spiritual thing. And so they approach it like that. So when it's time for birth, the community comes together to support that woman in that transition. And even after that transition. So things like postnatal care is so important in my culture. You know, a woman gives birth and in some cultures in Nigeria, the mother-in-law or her mother will come and stay with her for a long period of time. Could be 6 months, could be a year. She support her, help her to look after the baby, look after herself. And that care is there because they understand that it's not just the whole experience of pregnancy. Sometimes what happens after that, a woman needs that support. So look, cultures have things over the years that they have practiced in supporting women in this transition. And I think understanding these cultures are so important as well.
Absolutely. It's been fascinating speaking to you. Thank you so much. We really appreciate the work you're doing with Mayor's Legacy. And thank you for being part of Abigail's Footsteps podcast.
Thank you.
Baby loss charity Abigail's Footsteps offers counselling for grieving parents and specialist bereavement training for midwives and healthcare professionals. With compassion and care, Abigail's Footsteps has provided solace to countless bereaved families across Kent and the UK. Their Abbey cooling cots have allowed hundreds of parents to cherish precious moments and make memories with their baby, additional time they thought they might never have. Your generous support, help and donations will make all the difference in enabling this incredible Kent charity to continue their invaluable services. To learn how you can make a meaningful difference and support Abigail's Footsteps, visit their website at abigailsfootsteps.co.uk.
Thank you so much to Keji for sharing her story. Tianne Smith-Robinson has also been speaking about her experience. Tianne, thank you so much for being on this episode of the podcast. It's lovely to chat to you. Would you mind just talking to me about your baby loss experience firstly?
Thank you. I gave birth to my girl, as I call her. Her name's Jet, on the 27th of September 2021. But I experienced PROM, so, you know, preterm, premature membrane rupture. Essentially, my waters broke prematurely. Very normal day, went out. Went to get some food, takeaway, got back, and then I just had this sudden urge to go to the toilet. I was like, oh, that's a bit unusual. So I went to the toilet, and then I knew instantly that something was wrong because it wouldn't stop. So I started to panic, called my ex, my now ex, into the room, and I was like, I need to go to the hospital. So went to the hospital, had some checks, determined that my waters had broken, and then stayed overnight, had a scan. My fluid was very, very low, and that's when everything just felt like it was crashing down. So you can imagine going into a scan earlier on, felt positive because I was seeing my little baby grow, and I'd recently had my 20-week scan, so I knew I was having a girl, you know, told my family, my close friends, and I secretly wanted a girl, so I was very excited. But almost immediately, everything changed. I was on a different journey with my pregnancy and feeling like I was trying to cling on to a hope. When you prom, you do have the option to wait it out. Some women are lucky and managed to, you know, get to that safe point of 23 weeks, but I was shy of that. So at the time that I prommed, I was 20 weeks and 5 days. And then by the time I had her, I was almost 22 weeks. It was all very, very overwhelming. Living every day, still feeling her, just hoping that she'd be okay, that I would be okay. But if you know anything about prom, there's a high chance, very likely chance that you'll get an infection. And I did. So when I got the infection, I wasn't really sleeping. I was running on empty, absolute empty. I went to the toilet and then there was blood. So I was like, I've got the infection now. But I was so, so calm. I actually surprised myself how calm I was. And I think I just went into go mode, just step by step. It was almost an out-of-body experience. My mum had come down from Nottingham to stay with me, but I didn't want my mum coming to the hospital. So I spoke to Jay and I was like, you know, come to hospital with me. And he came. But it was difficult because I was on the ward. I could hear the machines, the monitors, being surrounded by other pregnant women who were having a very different journey to me. And I honestly think that I've got PTSD based on it now. But I was still very, very hopeful around everything. But then I had to make the decision because I was unwell. So I had to choose between, you know, me and my girl, which was very, very difficult. And then my labour journey started.
Up until that point, had your pregnancy been quite straightforward? You say you were really excited. You just found out you were having a little baby girl. Had everything been going okay?
A couple of times I had spotting, but nothing, you know, too concerning. So I visited the hospital a couple of times and she was doing fine. Nothing seemed, you know, abnormal or of real concern. So I just thought, you know, things happen and she'll be okay, I'll be okay. I was going through a very difficult time when I was pregnant, so I was quite stressed. In fact, I was very stressed, but my excitement was still there. Although I am a mum, I'm not having my experience the way I wanted to. I know that I'm destined to be a mum. I'm very maternal naturally. So my excitement was there and I was just preparing for her. I really was. And my mum would laugh at me because I'd be very strict about what I ate. You know, I drink lots of water anyway. So, you know, drinking lots of water and listening to classical music and dancing around the house and bonding with her. So yeah, in that sense, it was okay. Other than, you know, just having a difficult time outside of my pregnancy.
And had you, what you experienced, had you heard of that before? Were you aware that that could be something that could happen during a pregnancy?
Prom?
Yeah.
Yes, because one of my close friends, she had it, but she was further along. So she had to go on bed rest and her daughter was fine. So I had some knowledge, but it's very different when you're going through something yourself. So I was aware of it, yes. And unfortunately, I have other friends who have lost children. Not exactly the same thing, but I had an awareness and I'm an empath. So, you know, I feel things for people. But like I said, once you're going through something yourself, it's totally different.
Yeah, and you described it as almost like an out-of-body experience, like your body just takes over and it kind of tells you, this is what I now need to do. And you just go with that process. There's not much you can do. There's not a huge amount you can control. How was your experience though when you were in the hospital? Because you say you were around other mums, expectant mums, with all the machines going off and what have you. How was that experience while you were there?
It was quite overwhelming. When I was still waiting it out, it wasn't as apparent as when I had lost her. So I had my whole birthing experience. I gave birth and then I was supposed to have been put into a bereavement suite. When we got to the bereavement suite, it was full of mice droppings. And we were like, what is going on? This is awful. So they were like, oh, it was cleaned half an hour ago. So I was like, oh, well, this is even more alarming. This isn't great at all. But before that, actually, because it was around COVID time, post-COVID, my mum wanted to come and visit me in the hospital and it was agreed that she could come. But my mum got there and the lady on reception refused my mum entry and just really upset my mum. My mum's a very, very strong woman, but she just wanted to see me and my mum wasn't treated very well. So I heard her in the hallway and then she didn't come in the room for such a long time. So then I started worrying about my mum. Turns out she wasn't treated nicely and that wasn't great, you know. I've lost my child, or I'm losing my child. My mum wants to see me. You know, she's a comfort. And she wasn't treated with respect or kindness or gentleness. So that didn't feel good. But then fast forward to what I was just saying, the bereavement suite, it was awful. I couldn't stay in there. I was very unwell myself. And then they put me back onto the ward with expectant mothers. Granted, I was in a side room, but I could still hear babies crying. You know, mothers who had babies as well, actually. So I could still hear babies crying. I could still hear the monitors and essentially be in the same space as pregnant women as well and, you know, new mums and newborns, and it was too much.
Was there any sort of appreciation from staff that wasn't right?
Yeah, some staff. But I just felt at that point the care was terrible. I have to be honest, it was terrible. As you can imagine, I was having regular meds, regular checks, bloods taken. They left me for, I think it was about 5 hours. With nothing. So I felt like you were pushing me to make a decision, you know, about life or death, essentially. And then I've made that decision. Now I'm back here in this awful situation and nobody's caring for me where I'm supposed to be cared for. And I was just so overwhelmed and devastated. I was demanding to go home. I knew in my heart it wasn't the right decision, but I was just so overwhelmed and so heartbroken and upset that I wasn't getting the level of care that I should have been getting. I just wanted to go home. So Jay had to go and, you know, get somebody, and I was demanding a doctor to come and see me. And then they did a little bit better, but by that point, the damage was done. They moved me to a room that was a little bit further along, so further away from the main area. But the next day I was like, no, I'm going home today.
Did you get to spend any time with baby Jet at all? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, which I know that's really, really difficult to speak about. But Abigail's footsteps obviously has made that possible for an awful lot of families to spend those crucial moments with their little baby. What you went through afterwards was terrible, but was it still really important that you did get to spend that time?
Yes, and I'm very appreciative to Abigail's, honestly. I don't apologise for my emotions.
No, never apologise for that.
So yes, thanks to Abigail's, I had a cooling cot, a cold cot, and she was in there. They put her in this little, it was so funny as well, this little knitted outfit. And my mum, she loves to sew and she likes to knit. She doesn't knit so much now, but she just wanted her to be in like knitted outfits, you know, had she lived. And I was like, oh, mum, they're so old. And it was ironic that they put her in this little knitted outfit, the hat and I knitted dress. I love co-ords, so it was a coordinate, so that was good. We managed to spend some time with her. You know, I held her, but I didn't hold her for too long because that was overwhelming as well. But I had, you know, many opportunities just to, you know, she was in a small room off a labour suite, go and look at her. And I'm very tall, as you can see. I'm almost 6 foot and her dad is very, very tall. So she was so long. And when I look at pictures now, I look at her hands and I was like, oh my God, she was going to be a gazelle. I'm sure she would have been taller than me. Hopefully, you know, if she lived, play for netball, England team or something, you know. she was very cute and very tall.
And the fact that you can really smile and you have those memories, that must help in some of the really awful times. The fact that you did get to spend that time, even though the whole situation and the treatment was not good, you do have those precious memories still.
Absolutely. And all of my treatment wasn't bad. There were some real lovely people that were in the hospital that were supporting me, you know, midwives. So the entire thing wasn't bad. I don't want it to sound like that, but I have to be honest and speak frankly about my experience, especially as a black woman as well. But those moments with her, I definitely appreciated. And being able to, you know, look back at pictures, knowing that I was supported by Abigail's and I'm still supported by Abigail's through my therapist. I've raised money for Abigail's. The charity is very, very close to my heart. And definitely means an awful lot.
You mentioned there about being a black woman and the treatment that you received. We have seen some statistics, unfortunately, that suggest treatment for black women may not be as good as it should be. That must be awful to hear. That must be a terrible realisation that is a thing.
It is awful. And based on my experience and listening to other women's experience as well, it's not great. For me, I'm fortunate because I can advocate for myself. I can articulate myself. I can be assertive. Granted, at the time, you know, I was overwhelmed and in an awful situation, but some black women aren't able to for many different reasons. And yes, it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good at all. But I think it's important for myself, people like me, everyone, to advocate for others, to share our voices, to share our experiences as well, because we can empower people, we can raise concerns, we can challenge, you know, society, the healthcare system. So that's why I felt it was important to have this conversation as well. Even though I'm speaking about the most devastating time of my life, it's important to add my voice. And that is something that I've committed to since losing her. And I've had a lot of people come to me and say thank you. A lot of people who acknowledge their loss and who add their voices to the conversation as well. So whilst it doesn't feel good, I feel I have a role within that.
It sounds like there's still an awful lot of learning to be done. We've also had conversations as part of this podcast series about different cultures and how perhaps they're not respected. And you kind of think it's 2024. We need to make sure that that's known. Different people's cultures are known and respected within that healthcare setting.
Absolutely. So equality is important, but you know, equity is even more important. So we must be in the room to advocate for ourselves, to raise our voices. Look at what's happening at the moment. There's unrest in the UK. I know this is going to come out much later than now, but we must have a seat at the table, you know? So, yeah, I think, you know, that equity piece is more important. And we need to challenge. I made a complaint to the hospital. For a moment, I was considering not doing it, but I was like, no, this is what I have to say. And practices have to change. So we are going to do this complaint. And more of that needs to happen in order for real change to come about.
And as you say, conversations need to be had. We need to get those voices out there.
Absolutely. And there are many organisations who are advocating for black women, you know, black-led organisations as well. But it takes a village, doesn't it? There's a saying, it takes a village. So there just needs to be more conversation. And I feel a change, absolutely. So that's positive, but more progress is needed.
Yeah, that is a really positive thing. And we really appreciate you talking about your story and your journey and how much Abigail's has supported you. And as you mentioned, they are still supporting you now.
Yes, absolutely. My therapist is an earth angel, honestly.
That is lovely to hear. And you've also raised money for the charity, which an awful lot of people do. And a lot of people have said to us as part of this podcast, we wish we'd never heard of Abigail's Footsteps. But thank goodness, if they've experienced what they've experienced, Abigail's is there to help in so many different ways.
Absolutely. Yeah. I will always support Abigail's because they've helped me to still be here. So I'll always do a fundraiser. I'll always do something. But yeah, that's why I'm getting emotional, because although we don't want to be a part of this club, we're here, and I'm very appreciative of Abigail's.
And they are just a great big family, aren't they? That wraps you up.
Yeah, it feels like it.
Yeah, it really does.
Absolutely, yeah.
Tian, thank you so much for speaking to me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you to my guests, and on episode 5, we'll be hearing from some of Abigail's Footsteps' incredible fundraisers. Thanks for listening to A Journey with Abigail's Footsteps. If you'd like more information about Abigail's Footsteps or how you can make a difference by supporting or donating, please click abigailsfootsteps.co.uk or follow us on social media.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.